Look, Bumble knows you're exhausted by dating. All the, must not take yourself too seriously, and 6-1 since that matters, and what do I even say other than, hey? Well, that's why they're introducing an all-new Bumble, with exciting features to make compatibility easier, starting the chat better, and dating safer. They've changed, so you don't have to. Download the new Bumble now.
Better Call Paul is a production of Lola Media. Say hi, Lola.
Hey, everyone. This is Paul Sarker from Better Call Paul. Just wanted to remind you that the show is intended for entertainment purposes only and is not legal advice. I am not your lawyer unless we separately agree for me to represent you, and the views expressed by Mesh and me are solely our own. Hey, everyone. Welcome back to Better Call Paul, the show where we discuss the legal and business side behind the scenes of Hollywood sports and entertainment. I'm your co-host, Paul Sarker, former Marvel lawyer and current Big Law Media attorney.
And I'm your other co-host, Mesh Lakhani. Paul, how's it going? What's the latest?
It's going well, man. It's fall, which is nice. Lots going on in New York. The city's definitely buzzing. But I'll be honest, preparing for our final topic today was a bit of a downer for me. I'm trying to be excited about it, but it is sad. But all good. Can't complain.
You know, on a positive note, I mean, yes, New York has been buzzing. You know, we had just had the U.S. Open. Football season's underway. We've got good weather. It's New York Fashion Week. We just had the VMAs. So New York's been popping off this fall.
Although technically, you know, and VMAs were in Newark. But yes, I guess the metro area.
Fair.
I remember I was watching Sunday night and Monday night football were both New York teams. But Jess was, she was like, wait, there's no stadiums in New York. At least not in the city.
Yeah.
And I was like, oh yeah, no, they're in Jersey. She's like, and they're still New York teams?
I know.
So, anyway, VMAs were in Prudential Center. But still, you could say New York.
Here's the funny thing about the VMAs. I didn't know it was the VMAs until it was the VMAs. And I started seeing people tweet and put on TikTok that it was the VMAs. Because it was a Tuesday, which was, it's kind of random to be on a Tuesday night for an award show.
The VMAs meant a lot more to me when I was a kid and a teenager than they do now. But that could just mean that I'm old.
We're old, because I felt the same
way. We're older. And so, like, it may just be something that's directed more towards youth than, you know, my demographic segment right now. But it's basically a concert with a couple awards given out.
Which is the way it should be.
Right, which is the way it should be. Seemed like a super fun time. Taylor Swift won. Ice Spice, Best New Artist. Olivia Rodrigo performed. NSYNC did their beginnings of their reunion.
Yeah, those guys look pretty good, man. I'll say this. They were looking fit, ready for tour.
It's definitely something that they were probably looking forward to and prepping for. And there was like a 50th celebration of hip-hop. Lil Wayne performed. Diddy performed.
He got the global icon honor as well. It seemed to be a nice mix of like what is hip now amongst kids and then still amongst like millennials, you know, with Shakira performing, Diddy and NSYNC. I think Taylor Swift kind of falls in between millennials and Gen Z. So I think they're still appealing to an older demographic as well. I'm not sure that people are watching it, but they'll watch it on YouTube later.
Ratings were actually up significantly. I think they were up like 37%. From last year.
Yeah.
Part of that is, you know, a lot of the award shows are getting pushed, right? Because there's no one to write the material for them. And so they're getting impacted by the strike. I guess the VMAs doesn't really require a ton of writing. And Nicki Minaj was the MC. She gave a great performance. It was a high energy event and looked like a lot of fun. And not particularly far from the city, so maybe next year we'll check it out.
I'll go on TikTok to see what the crowd is saying about the VMAs, but I think the three people who seem to have won the show was Taylor Swift. I think people were obsessed with her having fun and watching Doja Cat's performance with Paint the Town Red. I'm not saying that I'm obsessed with TikTok. I try to keep in the know of what's happening with content, but that song is all over TikTok. There's currently like a dance that's going around. If you've seen it, it's actually pretty cool. And Doja Cat is winning TikTok. I think Taylor Swift was loving her song. And then, of course, you had Shakira, who did a 10-minute performance. And she still seems to be she still seems to be able to do a really good live show.
Shakira, yeah, that's her first performance since like 06.
Yeah, it's been a minute.
Yeah.
Yeah, I just saw highlights. I didn't watch the whole show, but I saw the highlights and it looked like it was okay.
It's also the end of, well, Fashion Week, I guess technically was last week by the time this episode comes out. And this year, I didn't go to any events. Jessica, we were both kind of bummed because we did it. Jessica did RSVP to, I think, two or three events, and things came up, so we weren't able to go. But fun time in general. Like, I don't fully understand fashion, but I think I have a sense of style. And when you see, like,
everyone's got a sense of style, Paul. Everyone's got their own individual.
Well, you know, I mean, I'm rocking a Versace tee, but it's not like.
Is that a Versace tee?
It is, yeah. You can see that. Medusa. But it's not because of Fashion Week, but it's not like I can't tell what's like. I have what I like, but I can't tell what something's when something's like objectively popular or going to be like the next thing.
I know what you mean. I appreciate that scene in Devil Wears Prada where Meryl Streep's character tells Anne Hathaway, you know, and she says it's just a belt or whatever it is. And she explains how it all starts, right? It's like some runway show, you know, with YSL that then eventually trickles down into Gap or the discount at Old Navy. But I think that's what's, it's really interesting. I mean, I don't also really understand Fashion Week from a art perspective, but I respect it. I think it's kind of cool that there are lines and there's trends that are basically being presented to people that could have an effect not only like economically and on multiple different brands, but just on years of fashion that could come.
Well, it's fun too, because there's a lot of pop-up events and you can get some free stuff. There's giveaways. Sometimes you have to wait in line for a while. Some things are open to the public. Usually you have to know someone or get on a list. My first experience with Fashion Week was right after the bar exam. I was like a baby lawyer, and one of my coworkers was like, let's go try to crash some Fashion Week events, because she was really into fashion. Mm-hmm. And it was fun. I mean, I don't think we got into too many, but it was still a good time.
There was a video that went viral of some quote unquote influencer who was paid to go to some after party at the Bowery Hotel. And it went viral because the person at the door, this gentleman, absolutely just destroyed her. When she was trying to get in, she was yelling at him, and she called everyone else who was waiting in line moochers, and she was paid to be there. And it might be one of the funniest things I've seen in like a live recording of someone getting yelled at in New York. So if you're interested in something like that, just type in New York Fashion Week after party on TikTok and you'll see what I'm talking about.
Yelling at a bouncer is probably not going to work out.
No, it's not going to work out in your favor, especially when they're good with their words. I got to imagine the people who control the guest list at an after party at New York Fashion Week are the last people you want to piss off.
Right. Or maybe Doja Cat.
or Doja Cat. But on that note, let's take a break and then we'll get back and we'll get down to business. We'll talk about the Toronto Film Festival and what's going on with AMC.
Last year, Mesh, Jess and I went to TIFF, which is a great film festival. Beginning mid-September, Toronto, the weather's gorgeous. And last year was the first TIFF after COVID. So it was super popular. A lot of celebrities because there weren't SAG and WGA strikes. And it was a great time. Jessica had a film premiering, Susie Searches. So we had an awesome time. Toronto's a great city. This year, we weren't able to go, but you know the show goes on. Although there were still strikes, right? SAG and WGA haven't resolved their strikes. So there were fewer high-powered talent and actors there. But SAG is really just a U.S. union, although some actors probably work overseas as well. There was still talent from South Asia. There were still, if you're an actor but also a director, the Directors Guild isn't on strike, so maybe you were able to show up and promote as you're in your capacity as a director. And a lot of good films. I really like, the thing I like about film festivals, probably two primary things. One, you get to do the Q&A with the filmmakers. They're not necessarily there for every showing, but they're there for a lot. And that is one aspect of it that's great. And then the other aspect, which is kind of related, is you can actually meet a lot of up-and-coming filmmakers and actors who aren't yet stars and interact with them and get a sense of like their motivations, their styles, what their goals are, the work they're putting in, how the travel schedule. And it's funny because like everyone's hustling, right? I mean, like we see the stars and it's like you get starstruck, but you know, they didn't always start out that way. And when you're building your career, it's such a grind. So it's fun to see. For me, one of the things I like is seeing that up and coming talent, seeing films that don't have a ton of resources, that don't have a ton of marketing, like maybe there's some word of mouth, some buzz. You go and you're blown away. That's what I really like about it.
Yeah, I've only experienced the Tribeca Film Festival, and I really love that about that festival, basically what you're describing. I did this course with a good friend of mine. I did a course in New York. I forget what program it was part of, but it was basically hosted by this like film critic. And he, every week you'd come and you'd watch a preview and he'd pick out the movies that he thought were going to be like not only showcased in the festivals, but potentially like in the award seasons. And it was awesome. You'd watch the movie at the end of each one. They'd bring in either the director or it was like, you know, the set creator or someone like that, the screenwriter. And it just felt different. It just felt like there was like, oh, wow, you get to really see the process and how much work goes into creating this stuff. And Sundance, for example, created by Robert Redford, was to do exactly that. Like not only just about all these big box office studio movies, but to represent young and up-and-coming filmmakers.
Well, that's how it started, yeah. And so certainly a lot of films are sold and like there's a big part of it is just sort of like networking and getting your film off the ground. But it's obviously become the domain of the streamers and large studios as well. So you have films that are already spoken for where their distribution deals are locked up and they just go there to generate award season buzz. TIFF has been a good predictor of award season success. If you remember Green Book, Nomadland were both won at TIFF. The Fablemans did really well last year. Jojo Rabbit, Three Billboards Outside Ebbing, Missouri. So a lot of times, you know, it's not necessarily the beginning of the award season, but it is where you would build momentum after Venice, after Cannes. And then New York Film Festival is at the end of the month. It's exciting.
So TIFF had a few things that were standouts from what I understand, from what I read. Obviously, in this case, like actors are not there promoting films. A lot of directors are standing with actors in solidarity, but there was a directing debut for a lot of big actors. Chris Pine, Anna Kendrick, Kristin Scott Thomas, Patricia Arquette, and then Taika Waititi. He had one. You know, obviously, he's a pretty seasoned vet, but like other ones, Viggo Mortensen.
He's more of a director than an actor.
Yeah. And then, yes. However, he has been, in, I guess, a lot of it in his own movies. And then
Korg.
Viggo, Korg, he's Korg. And then he was in Jojo Rabbit as yeah, obviously Hitler. And then Viggo Mortensen, he had his movie debut or new movie of his debut, Ethan Hawke and Michael Keaton. And from what I understand, critics weren't too happy. This is what I read in it was The Hollywood Reporter. Critics weren't too happy with the movies of some of the other directors, although Anna Kendrick's movie got a lot of good buzz. And she also stars in this film.
Women of the Hour?
Yeah, Women of the Hour. And then the other two movies that were standouts were The Holdovers by Alexander Payne, who had done Downsizing and stars Paul Giamatti. And then Jamie Foxx apparently was a standout in The Burial with, I think, Tommy Lee Jones that comes out this fall.
I've also heard American Fiction, which had Jeffrey Wright, who crushed it in Westworld.
Yeah.
It was directed by Cord Jefferson. The Beast, Evil Does Not Exist, was good. Perfect Days looks interesting to me. That's a Japanese film about a guy who cleans toilets, but he takes a lot of pride in doing that job and doing it well. And I guess he's training his like a junior worker to sort of take on the role with him. And then Olivia Colman in Wicked Little Letters. She was great. You know, I first saw her. I mean, she's been a seasoned actor for a long time, but I loved her in The Crown. And she was good in the last season of The Bear, you know, as the chef.
Yes, she was in The Bear. She was great. It was like super subtle. She was in Fleabag as the new stepmother. She was also fantastic. This was back in 2018. That's when I really noticed her. She was in The Favorite, which was Emma Stone, Olivia Colman, and Rachel Weisz, which was a fantastic movie. So glad to see her doing well. But I think it kind of goes back to, you know, what's happening right now. We still have the writer's strike. I think a little bit of nerves around what are we going to be able to watch in theaters and, you know, what's coming out. Obviously, there's still stuff that's up and coming. How is it going to affect the industry? How many delays are we going to have? But I think that brings us to our topic of AMC again, which we brought up from last week with the Taylor Swift Eras announcement. But they just raised a fresh $325 million. They issued 40 million shares of their stock at around $8. Obviously diluting themselves a bit, but they used it to clean up their balance sheet and essentially like get them set up. And they've had a pretty good run. They had Barbie, they had Oppenheimer, and of course they have the Taylor Swift deal. And I think it was a good time for them to raise money. But the other issue is that Hollywood strikes isn't helping them. It's creating more challenges in terms of people going to the movies, you know?
They've done this before at the market equity offering. As you said, 40 million shares, so about $325 million raised, which is great for them. They got to navigate this liquidity crunch. They don't have a ton of movies. There's not a ton in the pipeline. So yes, Barbie and Oppenheimer were a hit, but that's the thing. Any single movie is short-lived, really, when you think about it. It's just a month, maybe 6 weeks of really strong revenue at that. And then what's the next thing? So if you don't have a pipeline, it's really tough to keep operating. And then obviously we're in a really tough debt market where interest rates are high. So rather than taking on more debt, which they probably are paying down some debt with this money that they raised, it is good overall that they were able to do that. We talked about last week, they have the Taylor Swift Eras concert film, but that's just 4 weeks.
I wonder if they'll end up extending that, because if we actually look at the fall preview, and like one thing to think about is that how many movies are going to be pushed, you know, because of what's happening. The Dune sequel, which was supposed to come out in November of 2023, is now coming out in March of 2024. When I was actually looking at the fall preview, you know, there's not that many movies. Like there's not that many big, big movies. Like there's an Expendables movie coming out. There's a new Exorcist movie coming out. The Burial, what we just mentioned, but I don't imagine those are the type of movies, or The Burial, for example, is going to blow up the box office. Killers of the Flower Moon, obviously Martin Scorsese and Robert De Niro, Leonardo. Yeah, but that's,
isn't that Apple?
Oh, that's right. It's Apple.
It might be released theatrically, but it's not being released to make theatrical box. It's really, that's more just to get the awards.
That's a really good point. And then, I mean, besides that, there's a Priscilla movie coming out in October. And I'm really trying to find stuff here. There's a Hunger Games movie and Napoleon, but that's also Apple TV. So it's all very unclear.
The other thing that's tough is, like, all else being equal, like, they still haven't rebounded from the pandemic. It's not like people are going to the extent, Barbenheimer being the exception, but generally speaking, numbers are down. They need to raise cash. It's better than taking on debt, which has a higher interest rate, I guess. I guess it depends on how you look at it, but good for them. And their stock went up 8% after doing it.
It's a good move. It's a good move to raise money right now to pay off debt when it's so high, get your balance sheet situated. Because we've got to imagine that maybe this fall, maybe, you know, 2023 is going to be a rough year for movies again, besides Barbie and Oppenheimer, which basically is like the year of movies. Plus add Taylor Swift in there. You've had a pretty good year. And maybe that actually that pushes over a little bit to 2024, to where we can actually see a potentially like the summer where things could maybe kick back. Who knows? I don't know what the plan is. It's interesting.
It is. Good for AMC.
Yeah, good for AMC fans over here of AMC, because I really like the fact that you can, you know, pick your own drink. But yeah, look, let's take a break and we'll get back and we'll get to serious stuff. We're going to talk about Danny Masterson and his whole trial.
So, Mesh, this is a tough one. This is a story that when it first broke, I wanted to sort of like avoid it, but it's just such a sad topic that I didn't really want to focus on it. But then it grew into a much bigger story and potentially unearthing a lot of conspiracies. But it's a Danny Masterson trial, right? So he was convicted of 2 counts of rape, sentenced to 30 years to life, which is a very high sentence, which means that whatever he was convicted of was really heinous and there was a lot of evidence. So that is what it is. And I think there had been rumors about him for a while, but he hadn't actually been tried until recently. Although when the speculation surfaced in 2016, he was actually written off of the ranch. His career has basically been destroyed for probably 7 or 8 years, but now he's going to, although his lawyers say they're going to appeal, but we don't know. But the real story, this is a horrible thing that he did. And, you know, we can get into the facts of what he did. But the reason it took on a whole new life is because a lot of prominent actors from That 70s Show, namely Ashton Kutcher, Mila Kunis, and a lot of other people he's worked with over the course of his career, wrote letters of support on his behalf to the judge, begging for leniency, saying that he was a solid guy and he had a lot of redeeming qualities and that he shouldn't be, even though he is a rapist, he shouldn't have to do that much time, I guess, was their point.
It's insane. I mean, it's absolutely insane. Cause like I was reading, I'm like, I mean, I don't care what the situation is. Like if your friend is being convicted of rape, maybe like if it was, I'm just putting a what if, if it was one of those like early allegations and he had nothing, like no rumors or anything about him, and you know, you think that he's an innocent guy, there's one thing. This is after he had already been, like, the sentencing was happening after he had been, hey, this guy like drugged and raped two women. The third one they didn't have enough evidence on over 20 years ago, and it was like pretty bad, like evil type scenario. And then you have these people coming in like laughing about it, and you know, obviously, there's a whole Scientology part of this. Like, the Masterson grew up around Scientology. He's a Scientologist.
He's a prominent member of the church.
He's a prominent member of the church.
Both of the women who came forward, or all three, I guess, were involved in the church as well.
Yes.
And they were invited to his home for like birthday parties, and it was like Scientology members. They said, although the Church of Scientology denied it, that they said, you know, there's this policy not to bring charges or complain about what other senior members of the church do.
Right? Yeah, to handle it like one-on-one or whatever.
Yeah, exactly.
Right?
Like, you know, not to go to the police. And it's hard enough, right, to get a rape case to trial, because it's so often devolves into he said, she said, whether there was consent. You know, you have to prove non-consensual forcible sex injury between, in California, people who aren't married. And it is, you know, it's a very hard thing to get enough evidence on, which is why a lot of prosecutors don't bring these cases, and
right.
a lot of times they'll try to settle them. And sometimes there's a lot of instances of very lenient sentences, particularly one with Brock Turner, the Stanford student. This was like a particularly heinous one because he only got 3 months. And so the fact that Danny Masterson got 30 years to life means that whatever the evidence was shown at trial was really, really condemning and horrible. But then to have all these people come out who weren't there, who were just like, oh, well, he's a good guy because of XYZ. And I think they only wrote
after the after all right. this evidence has been submitted.
And I think they only wrote the letters because they thought they would be confidential.
Right, right. It was supposed to be to the judge only.
But it doesn't change the fact that it is what it is, right? Because it's public. So the judge has discretion to release it. And the judge, Charlene Olmedo, basically said, I only accept letters like this under seal if it's really to protect someone, if it's like the case of imminent danger. If someone just like doesn't want the public to know that they're supporting a rapist, then that's not a reason enough. And so Mila Kunis and Ashton Kutcher, who for, you know, the past 10 years had sort of branded themselves as people who want to work to stop sex trafficking, the fact that they wrote these letters, it seems really hypocritical. And then it started causing people to dig deeper into Ashton Kutcher and That 70s Show and Mila Kunis, the fact that she was 14 when she started on that show.
Yeah.
And he was over, I think he was 5 years older than her, and they had a relationship, and they're questioning whether she was groomed. And then looking into his organization, Thorn, which he stepped down from, but how some of the people on the board of Thorn have actually been accused of really, really bad stuff, and how Thorn had been working with the CIA, who had in the past been linked with, I don't know, being part of the problem in some ways. It's hard for me to get into it because I don't really know, but it's...
Well, it just makes you think, like, you just can't trust any of these people in the public eye, like an Ashton Kutcher, who's been in the public eye since we were... I mean, That 70s Show was, like, back in the, late 90s, and then there was Punk'd, and then he became this, like, you know, I'm this prolific venture capitalist, And meanwhile, this guy's writing a statement to say that this person who is convicted of rape of two women, that he's a role model and, quote unquote, a person that is consistently there for you when you need him. It's just like, what is going on here? And then also there's something that came out about him. Not that he had anything to do with it, but a girl that he was seeing at the time during That 70s Show was murdered, and he like came into her house, and then he realized that she was murdered, so he like ran out, and then he called his like agent and everyone. He's like, my fingerprints are on the door. Like, he didn't have anything to do with the murder, but it was more like around the character.
Is it obvious?
Because someone else was convicted. It was more that it was the character of him.
What does that mean?
It was more, from what I read, it was more the character of him to run out and call his team and be worried that he was there and what the cops are going to say, versus like, oh my God, my girlfriend just got murdered. Like, I should call the cops or something like that. Right. And like, apparently it was like in some statement. I'm now just reading what I'm reading on the internet, so take this with a grain of salt.
I mean, that's the thing. I mean, it just causes anyone, I think, to like question who are these people really? And like, do they present this image to manipulate the public and to make people think a certain way? Ashton Kutcher, I even thought like he basically put his career on the back burner to work to solve this problem of human sex trafficking. But in reality, you know, maybe he doesn't care about that at all. And maybe he's just like, maybe that's just a front.
Who knows?
That, you know, people that he's friends with can continue to get away with whatever it is they do, their predatory behavior. I don't know.
Yeah.
But Topher Grace never got along with Danny Masterson or any of the cast on that show. And he left early and he's looking at this. He, like, in hindsight, he seems like the most decent person on the show. Wilmer Valderrama did not write a letter of support for Danny Masterson. So it's not like everyone supports this guy, but enough people do where it's really concerning.
Well, it's also like, again, I don't know if this has anything to do with, I think a lot of the earlier members of That 70s Show were also involved in Scientology. Laura Prepon, who was also in That 70s Show and Orange is the New Black, she was part of Scientology. She left apparently after she had a kid. She soon left the church. But it is interesting to see, like, I don't know if it's like a cultish thing of support, but I think what happened that was even worse, so worse than the actual letters, is that once the letters got leaked, Kunis and Kutcher put a video out, which I think has made things even worse, and saying, you know,
their apology video?
Their apology video where they said, like, quote unquote, we support victims. We have done this historically through our work and will continue to do so in the future. Apparently, they said something about it was only intended for the judge to read, but we don't want to discount, obviously, what happened to
these
victims.
They support the victims, yeah.
They support the victims. Hearts go out to every single person who have ever been victim of a sexual assault, sexual abuse, or rape. And then Christina Ricci actually came out and said, you know, there's many a times in Hollywood that I've met people that have disappointed me. And she said, always believe the victims. And, I think Kutcher, I have another quote here that says, while I'm aware that the judgment has been cast as guilty on two counts of rape by force and the victims have a great desire for justice, I hope my testament to his character is taken into consideration in sentencing. Who the hell advised you to write that?
He doesn't care about the victims. I mean, that's the only
clear
logical explanation. I mean, it's just like they were, you know, meaningless to him.
Yeah. I mean, and then, the last thing he said, I do not believe he is an ongoing harm to society and having his daughter raised without a present father would be an injustice in of itself. Like, dude.
He wasn't convicted of all three counts. He was convicted of two. Whatever happened when the victims testified, it clearly spoke to the judge. And then the other thing is, he had done a lot of sketchy stuff. He said his DJ name was Donkey Punch.
Jesus.
He had an appearance on Conan where he said, like, you know, how he typically introduces himself. Hey, I'm Danny Masterson, like, grab my balls or something.
Conan
ended the interview Hey, I know I've heard about you. You're going to get caught. And it was like, it wasn't planned. And Conan wasn't really supportive, but he also, it was ambiguous enough that it wasn't like, it's sort of like Danny Masterson laughed it off, but I think his reputation is out there and it's just like he's been protected for a long time because he's privileged. He was born into an acting family. He's a high-ranking member of the church and he thought he could get away with this. And his attorney, Sean Holly, still claims that he has grounds to appeal and that they're going to appeal. And, you know, that's her job, I guess, is to defend people like this. But I don't think I could do it, man.
Yeah, man. And I think anyone who supports someone like this after things have been proven, I think everyone kind of should just bounce. Like, we don't need to see you supporting causes that you clearly don't care about. I mean, I mean, this is how pathetic some of these statements were. I was reading some of them. This guy, Ethan Supley, who's one of the guys in Remember that more heavy set guy from Remember the Titans and American History X. He was in Mallrats and he was writing basically that Danny Masterson had commented about how he should take care of the clothes on set and not leave them on the ground for the people to pick up for laundry and taught him how to hang them up properly. And he said he always remembered that. And he said he always remembered how Danny Masterson taught him to, like, respect the laundry. Like, that was him saying this guy's character, it says something about him. I'm like, okay, man, like, that's what you're trying to find? Like, this guy's character, it comes down to laundry? Give me a break. So look, the guy's getting what he deserves. He's in jail for a really, really long time. And anyone associated with him who supported him after his conviction, you know, should be on the downhill as well, in my personal opinion.
Agreed. I'm glad it came to light. I'm glad the judge said, no, these letters are going to be public. And she also said to Danny Masterson at trial, you're not the victim here. This isn't about protecting you anymore. Like, this is about getting justice for the victims. You're the perpetrator. And all the people that want to protect you and say that you're a solid guy, they need to be outed as who they are.
Yeah, they do. 100%. And they've been outed. When the internet turns on you, man, and they've definitely turned on him probably more than Mila Kunis, but specifically on Ashton.
Well, I thought Mila, from the apology video, it was clear that Mila like didn't want to write the letter in the first place.
Yeah, it's just a weird thing to say on camera or even write out. So, and here's my other opinion about like when you're a young, good-looking dude and you become really famous and wealthy at a young age, I don't care, man. Like, unless you have like really, really good people around you and some really strong morals, like ego and narcissism is a deadly, deadly game. And you have to be completely, really, really self-aware to avoid that. So I wouldn't put it past any of these kids in Hollywood who rose to fame during that era and just kind of stayed on top for a really long time. So I'm glad that it's coming down.
Bring it all to light. That's the only way we can really heal.
Well, hopefully next week we'll have some more positive things to talk about. But on that note, Paul, let's...
That's our show for this week, folks. Sorry to end on a sad note, but, you know, it's not all fun and games.
Sorry to end on a sad note, but justice is served. Danny Masterson is in prison for a really long time. But that's our show, and make sure that you're subscribed to the podcast, Apple, Spotify, wherever you choose to listen. Follow us on Instagram, TikTok, Better Call Paul, the podcast. Follow me on Twitter, at Mesh Lakhani. Better Call Paul is produced and edited by Valentino Rivera and assistant producer Lisa Sanders. Have a great week.
Thanks, everyone.